but she was far more angry than scared. And she remembered a horror movie Barry had forced her to watch, in which parents had booby-trapped their house to catch their daughter's murderers, and she wished she could do the same thing here. Right now, the thought of Bill and his smug little look-alikes speared on some makeshift shiv sounded mighty appealing. Neither of them had bothered to look at the time, but as they went from room to room, checking to make sure nothing was broken or stolen, turning off the lights, she saw by the clock in the kitchen that it was 2:30. It was another 10 minutes before they were back in bed, and although Barry was snoring almost instantly, it was a long time before she was able to fall asleep. As early as was polite, she called Liz. Barry was taking his shower, and she poured herself a cup of coffee while she dialed her friend's number. The voice that answered halfway through the first ring was wary and suspicious.
Yes?
Hello, Liz? It's me, Maureen. Maureen. Her name was repeated in a disassociated monotone that raised the hackles on her neck and set off alarm bells in her head.
Liz? Are you all right?
Fine, I'm fine. But the monotone remained, her friend's voice drained of its usual life.
What happened? What did they do?
Liz didn't answer. Maureen spoke quickly before her friend hung up.
It's the association, she said. That's why I'm calling. They've come down on us for our interior decorating. We woke up in the middle of the night and five of those assholes had broken into our house to inspect it. They told us we had to get rid of family photos and personal effects, and we had to rearrange our entire house.
Liz's voice exhibited its first sign of emotion. Fear.
The middle of the night?
Yes. They always come in the middle of the night. Again, the monotone.
What happened to you? Maureen asked once more.
No, don't say anything. I understand that you can't talk over the phone. I'll come up.
No,
her friend said sharply.
Liz, do not come to see me.
The words were bitten off.
I know you're... It's not safe.
The old woman's voice was replaced by a dial tone. She'd hung up, and Maureen stared blankly down at the phone for a moment, unsure of what to do. If she called back, Liz probably wouldn't answer, and if she did answer, she'd be angry. She'd been specifically ordered not to go to Liz's house, so that was out of the question.
Tina.
Maureen found the other woman's number and called. Mike answered the phone, and she asked to speak to his wife. A minute later, Tina was on the line, sounding sleepy.
Hello?
This is Maureen. Did I wake you up?
Sort of.
Sorry, but it's kind of an emergency.
She explained about their nighttime visitors and about her unsettling call to Liz.
First things first, she said. What do we do about Liz?
What can we do? You know what happened last time. We all tried to help her, but she just shut us out.
I'll call her myself later, go up there if she'll let me, and maybe call Audrey and Moira too. But I'll tell you true, I have a feeling it's going to be the same situation. There may be nothing we can do. She might have to just work it out herself.
And if she can't? Tina didn't answer.
What about our situation?
Tina sighed.
I wondered when they were going to crack down on you.
You knew about this?
I guess.
Why didn't you say anything? Why didn't you tell me?
I thought maybe you'd squeaked by. Maybe they hadn't seen the inside of your house or for some reason didn't want to make you conform.
I didn't want to worry you unnecessarily or draw attention and let them know that you'd escaped them, but
I guess in the back of my mind I knew it would happen.
You should have told me about this, Maureen said.
You're right, I'm sorry.
Her voice was wistful.
But it was nice seeing family photos again, and more than one wall of pictures and hangings. And all those collectibles and antiques you have.
You're still going to see them, Maureen told her. We're not changing anything. There was a pause, as if Tina did not know how to respond to that.
But you have to.
What if we don't?
Tina's voice grew lower.
The fines will start, and you don't want to get into that cycle, believe me.
Then what can we do?
There's nothing you can do, Tina said. It's something we all have to put up with.
Middle-of-the-night inspections?
Well, she admitted, ours have never been in the middle of the night. Probably they just wanted to rattle you.
That's selective enforcement right there, then. They're treating us differently than they treat everyone else.
I don't know if I'd say that, Tina added quickly. We've escaped it, but that doesn't mean other people have.
But you'd stand up for us? You'd tell the truth? You'd sign a statement saying that your inspections have all been at reasonable hours?
More backpedaling.
Sign a statement?
I'd have to talk to Mike about that.
Tina obviously wasn't going to be much help, and if she wasn't brave enough to stand up to the association, Maureen was sure no one else would be. Rather than tempering her anger, the disappointment she felt only fueled it further, and she said a quick goodbye. She and Barry were in this alone. They'd have to face down the association by themselves. But that was okay. They didn't need anybody else. When Barry came out of the shower, she was sitting at the dining room table, staring out the window at the trees, nibbling on a piece of cold toast.
"Did you call Liz?" he asked.
"And Tina."
"And?"
he prodded when she didn't elaborate. She told him about both conversations, about Liz's frightened paranoia and Tina's ineffectual support.
"What do you want to do?" Barry asked.
"Do you still want to go back to California?"
"Hell no."
"That's the spirit."
"Fuck 'em," Maureen said, and the words felt good.
"We're not going anywhere. We're staying here just long enough to wipe our asses with those damn CC&Rs.
37.
It was another fine. He had paid none of them yet, but they'd been arriving daily, signed by the association's treasurer, someone named Thompson Hughes. They were all ridiculously inflated, and although he hadn't kept track, the total they owed must be well over $3,000 by now. It was ludicrous that they were being penalized in such a way for minor infractions of unreasonable rules, and he'd saved each of the notices for a future court case. Barry dropped the rest of the mail on the coffee table and tore open the unstamped envelope. This one was levied against them for failure to park both of their vehicles facing in the same direction. For that offense, the association was docking them $750.
$750 this time, he said.
Maureen looked up from her book.
Losers.
With the fine notice was another form, and he unfolded the paper and scanned its contents.
Jesus, he breathed.
What's it say?
The title is Bath and Toilet Violations. Does that give you some clue?
Let me see that.
He handed her the paper.
Someone has apparently been monitoring our bathroom habits. It says that you do not have the right number of tampons or maxi pads, that a certain surplus number is required, which you have failed to maintain, and that we are discharging 3 gallons more effluent than is allowable for a domestic residence with 2 people.
Her face paled as she read.
My God.
She looked at him.
You think they have a camera in there?
It's possible.
And I'm going to get some wallpaper and cover over every square inch of the wall and ceiling just in case. But that maxi pad tampon thing is not something that you could find out with a camera. Someone's been snooping. Someone's been in the house.
But when? We've been home all the time.
While we were sleeping, he said, and the thought of it curdled his blood. Bill and his inspectors were one thing. As invasive and intrusive as that had been, at least they'd been open about it. At least they had made their presence known. But the idea of people breaking into their home and sneaking around in the dark, checking on Maureen's feminine hygiene products and God knew what else, made his skin crawl. Who were they? And how many of them? The scenario conjured by his writer's imagination had Kenny and the most disfigured volunteers creeping, crawling, and limping silently through the rooms of the house, peeking at and examining their most intimate items, fingering his condoms, sniffing Maureen's dirty panties. And the scary thing was, but he was probably not that far off the mark. He did indeed put wallpaper over the walls and ceiling, rounding off the corners so there would be no cracks or gaps through which miniature devices could peer. They had several rolls left over from their initial renovation, and it occurred to him that perhaps he should re-wallpaper the entire house, or at least those rooms where they'd painted rather than papered the walls, but the thought was intimidating. He recalled how much work they'd done that first month, and he didn't want to go through that again unless he absolutely had to. Besides, there was no indication that any other rooms were under surveillance. Maybe they needed to watch BVTV more often. As he should have expected, the next day they received a notice alerting them that they had made unauthorized changes to a room's appearance without getting approval from the Interior Design Committee. They were required to both pay an $820 fine and remove the wallpaper. "Fuck that," he said. "I wonder how the people before us survived," Maureen said. "This place was like a bat cave when we bought it. They must have broken at least as many decorating rules as we have." "Maybe they didn't survive." She looked at him quizzically. "Did you notice on all those papers we signed when we bought this place that it said Jordan and Sarah Gardner Trust? I wondered about that at the time. I assume it meant that the owners were dead and their relatives were selling off the house. Probably to pay the fines." They spent the afternoon at Mike and Tina's. Liz was still avoiding contact with everyone, hiding reclusively in her house, keeping her door locked and her drapes drawn, and they were all worried for her, though none of them had any ideas of how to help. Maureen had sent her a long letter through the mail, trying to appeal to the old woman's logical side and assuring her that she had a lot of allies and didn't have to face anything alone, no matter what it was. But no one was even sure if Liz was collecting her mail these days. "I'll tell you one thing," Mike said. "This wouldn't have happened if Ray was still here." "A lot of things wouldn't have happened if Ray was still here," Barry agreed. Indeed, Ray's death seemed to have been the catalyst for much of what had occurred since. He had been a sort of unofficial opposition leader, the only person with enough influence and gravitas to counteract the association's monopolization. And once he was out of the way, once that domino had fallen, everything else had started to come undone. Barry wanted to get the names of the people who had attended the Dysons' parties, all of Ray's anti-association acquaintances. "We can put together a petition," he said. "Try to get a recall." "First of all," Mike told him, "there are no recalls. It's disallowed. There's no such thing here. Secondly, the annual meeting is coming up on Labor Day weekend. That's when they vote for officers, make amendments to the CC&Rs, conduct all that sort of association business. It's when they allow us mortals to see the man behind the curtain." "So that's our big chance." "Yeah. If I can talk to enough people, get them to propose, second, and vote for a number of different initiatives, we can institute some of our own reforms."
"In theory."
"You don't think it's possible?"
"Let's just say I've been to these meetings before. I know how they go."
"Is it true that on the ballot you can only approve the existing board? There's no other choices?"
"Oh, yeah."
"You also have to bring your federal income tax forms to the meeting," Tina said. "The ones from last year. That's when we turn them in." Maureen frowned.
"Why is that?"
"It's required," Mike said. "As crazy as it sounds, the courts have upheld this. It's perfectly legal. I would have thought it was an invasion of privacy, but an association can require full financial disclosure from any homeowner who belongs to it, and of course our association does."
Maureen turned toward Barry. "That's how they learned about the precariousness of the Davidsons' finances, why they knew that an increase in property taxes would force them to move."
Mike nodded.
"Yep."
"About Greg Davidson," Barry said.
"What?"
"At Ray's party, he said they were going to sell their house and move. His brother or someone had found him a job in Arizona."
"Yeah."
"But they didn't move. I saw Greg. He's one of the volunteers. I don't know what happened to Winona, but Greg was helping to dig the pool, and he was at the gate the night of the rally." Mike and Tina exchanged a look. Barry caught it, but he didn't know what it meant, and suddenly he wasn't sure if he should say any more. He thought about Frank and Audrey, open my box, and realized that he really didn't know Mike and Tina any better. His gut said they were okay, and they seemed to have all the right ideas, but in Bonita Vista, you could never tell. Maureen seemed to have caught the same vibe. You don't want to talk about the volunteers.
It's not that, Tina said. It's just...
She looked over at her husband. We didn't find out about them for a long time ourselves, Mike offered. And you're right, they're not something that people talk about. Everyone knows they're there, and they help clear the roads after big storms and stuff, but we like to pretend like we don't know anything about them. Barry shook his head.
I don't understand why you...
I volunteered for a week myself. They were stunned, silent. If Mike had said he'd murdered his first wife and met Tina after his release from prison, it could not have been more shocking, and Barry marveled at how sinister such a mundane concept had become in this whacked-out world.
I truly did volunteer, Mike said. I was fined $100 for violating Article 8, going outside in the morning to pick up my newspaper while wearing a bathrobe. You're not supposed to appear outside the house wearing a robe. We could have paid the fine, but our refrigerator was going. We'd been saving up for a new one, and this would have put us back another month. I'd heard through the grapevine that you could volunteer, that you could work off your fine instead of pay it, and I approached the board and they said okay. I was assigned to pick up trash on the roads and in the ditches for a week.
And that was it? Barry asked.
Not exactly. On Saturday, the last day, I was told to help clear dried brush from one of the greenbelts, and I found out for the first time that there were gradations of volunteers. There were people like me, who were assigned specific tasks for a specific amount of time, and there were people who weren't trying to work off anything. They were just volunteering to help out, and they could pretty much do whatever they wanted to on whatever needed to be done.
He licked his lips.
Then there were the indentureds, and I'm pretty sure that's what Greg is. They're the ones who've lost their homes but owe so much that even that doesn't cover it. They pretty much sign away their lives, forfeit their rights, and are at the association's beck and call until their debts are paid off. They supposedly live together in a bunkhouse somewhere, although I still don't know where that is. I've never asked.
Barry was expecting more, but apparently Mike was through.
That's it? He said.
There has to be more to it than that. You were at the gate that night. You saw them. Greg and the rest of them were like robots. They looked like they were drugged or hypnotized or something.
It's not that, Mike insisted. I can't explain it, but there's nothing truly coercive involved. No magic or drugs or brainwashing or anything.
They really can walk away if they want to, although I have no doubt that they'd have their asses sued off if they did. But they're in so deep to the association that they stay. They'll do anything to get themselves out from underneath that rock.
Another of those looks at Tina.
Anything.
But,
Maureen looked at Barry.
They all seem to be mutilated in some way. There's something wrong with all of them. They're missing ears or fingers or hands.
Volunteering is not the only way to pay off debts, Tina said through tight lips.
That was as detailed as either of them would get, and Barry wasn't inclined to push them further. There was something else there, but while Mike and Tina were being evasive, it was out of fear, not malice, and he understood their apprehension. Mike, in particular, had to walk a thin line. Although he worked for a national corporation, his office was in town, and while he disagreed with and resented the association, they pretty much left him alone. It was not in his best interest to rock any boats. After some innocuous chit-chat that allowed them all to depressurize a bit, Barry and Maureen finally took their leave, making tentative plans to play tennis with the Stewarts next weekend. They returned home to find Maureen's garden gone. They'd only been away for a few hours, but in that time someone, the volunteers, had not only torn out and disposed of every bush, vine, sapling, flower, and vegetable that Maureen had planted, but had packed down the dirt and placed in it dozens of dead and dying manzanita bushes.
What is this?
Maureen asked incredulously. The land on the north side of the house looked like a cruel parody of the property as it had appeared when they bought the house, as though a blight had descended on native shrubs, killed most of them off, and left a few weakened specimens in its wake. Guess what? Barry said. He pointed toward the screen door. A pink sheet of paper. Oh, no. Maureen reached the door first and ripped off the form. Barry read over her shoulder. They were being fined for non-compliance with regulations and would also be charged for the labor and materials supplied by the gardening enterprise, which replaced the offending plants with acceptable local vegetation.
Acceptable local vegetation? Maureen fumed. They stuck some dead twigs in the ground.
Don't worry, we're not paying it.
That's not the point. They destroyed my garden. My tomatoes still had blooms, and another batch was about to ripen. I had zucchini that was ready to pick.
I wonder if there's some sort of grievance committee. Someplace we could go to complain about an action like this. Fat chance. They should have to take responsibility for this. We were told specifically, after that first time with Barney, that we were allowed to have a garden and to landscape our property.
That's not all. Look.
He read the line to which she was pointing. It stated that all flowers and houseplants had to be removed from the inside of the residence within 48 hours. Otherwise, additional fines would be imposed. The amount was unspecified. They were both agreed that no changes would be made. Their plants would be neither moved nor removed. Since the inspection, they'd been tilting dining room chairs and placing them under the doorknobs in order to discourage intruders, but Bill and his buddies had somehow found a way to unhook a chain latch and throw back a keyless deadbolt, so this extra precaution probably hadn't amounted to much. Still, Barry vowed that tonight he would also duct tape the edges of the doors. At the very least, it might tell them if someone had broken in while they were sleeping. Maureen decided to walk through where her garden used to be and see if any of her plants had been spared. Barry went inside. He had an idea. He was pretty sure that Maureen would not approve, so he waited until she came back in and told her that he was going to walk around the property and do his own inspection. Our homeowner's insurance might cover this, he told her. So after I look around, I'm going to take some photos and call them to file a claim, see what comes of it. She thought it was a good idea. He did intend to take pictures and file an insurance claim, but he also had more immediate plans. From underneath the bottom deck where he stored their gardening implements, tools, and leftover renovation materials, he found what he was looking for, a large cardboard box. Using a pair of clippers, he raggedly cut off one side and then placed it on the ground and painted a short, crude message. The only color of paint they had was white, but against the dark brown of the cardboard, the letters stood out and were clearly visible. Barry positioned the sign at the base of a scrub oak, using a large rock to hold it in place, and walked out to the street to make sure his message was legible and could be read by passing cars. Fuck the Homeowners Association. It was legible, all right. He grinned. This would show those bastards. He'd be fined, but it was worth it to him to make sure that they were aware of his defiance, that they knew he was willing to take his dissatisfaction public. Besides, he'd just throw the fine notice in a drawer with the others. He walked back inside, still smiling, and got the camera out. He took pictures of the damage from different directions, then, just for fun, took a picture of the sign. He was cheered up for about 10 minutes, but then he started thinking about all the time he'd wasted on this crap, all of the hours spent worrying and responding and thinking and brooding that could have been used for more productive purposes, and suddenly he no longer felt so good. His thoughts turned to those creepy old men of the board and the futility of fighting against such entrenched institutionalized power. Maureen was lying on the couch, watching the Home and Garden Channel, mourning her lost plants. She, too, seemed drained. She'd been all fired up after their nighttime inspection, ready to go to war with the entire world if need be, but subsequent harassment had taken its toll, and now she looked positively beaten down. Was any of this really worth it?
Maureen must have been thinking along the same lines because she sat up, using the remote to mute the television's sound.
"Maybe we should move," she said.
He didn't respond.
"We can leave and still save face. We didn't buckle, we didn't cave, we stayed. We showed them. Now let's sell this place and put this hell behind us."
There was a quaver in her voice.
"Please?"
Barry nodded tiredly.
"Okay." "Thank God," Maureen said. "Thank God."
And he found that he felt the same way, off the hook, filled with relief. "It's over," he thought. "It's finally over." 38. Barry sat in Doris's office, enduring the hostile stares of her co-workers. The real estate agent was on the phone, discussing a seller's willingness to carry with an obviously jittery buyer, but the fat man and the skinny woman who worked for her had nothing to do and behind her back were fixing him with the type of glare usually reserved for disciples of Adolf Hitler. He was pretty sure he'd seen both of them at the rally. Doris hung up and fixed him with a bright smile.
"Sorry about that. What can I do for you?"
"Well, it's not Bert, is it? He's not causing you any problems."
We want to sell our house."
"Oh." The real estate agent nodded, stood.
"Come on, let's go into the conference room."
She led him into the other half of the trailer, closed the door behind them, and pulled out two adjoining chairs from the table.
"Have a seat."
He followed her lead. "Your agents don't seem too thrilled to see me here."
"Don't you worry about that. They'll do what I tell them to do, and they'll think what I tell them to think, or they'll be fired."
"I understand their feelings. Been running into a lot of it lately. We're not exactly the most popular people in town right now."
"I don't care what other people say," Doris told him. "I understand Bonita Vista. I've sold enough homes there."
She smiled at him, leaned over, and patted his leg reassuringly. But the hand remained in place a beat too long, and when she finally moved it away, her fingers brushed his crotch. He looked out the room's small window, afraid to meet her eyes. He was pretty sure she was coming on to him, but he didn't want to encourage her and tried to think of some way to make it clear that he was not interested, that this was strictly a business meeting.
"I found that the people in Bonita Vista are very nice," she said.
He turned to face her, and she lowered her eyes in a way that she probably thought was sexy, but instead seemed crude and embarrassingly obvious. It was a class thing, he realized. It was terrible to admit, even to himself, but as much as he hated that damn homeowners association, he felt more at ease with the residents of Bonita Vista than he did with the people of Corbin. He wanted to be a conscientious liberal, to be one with the masses and all that good shit. But when it came down to it, he had money, he was educated, and he just didn't belong with these people. He looked at Doris with her big hair and loud clothes and overlarge jewelry, and there was not even a flicker of interest, no temptation whatsoever. The fact that she was sympathetic to Bonita Vista turned him off even more, and he wondered if everyone who had dealings with Bonita Vista was automatically corrupted. The sheriff, Doris. It seemed like whoever came in contact with the gated community and the association was influenced somehow. He'd been reading and writing too many horror novels. No. He wished that was the case, but it wasn't.
"Where do you live?" he asked.
"Out on Bars Ranch Road."
She leaned forward, confiding in him. He smelled too strong perfume.
"But I own a lot in Bonita Vista, and I'm going to build a house there in a few years."
The hairs on the back of his neck prickled.
"Well, we want to sell our house," he told her.
"I'm sorry to hear that. I really am. Corbin is situated in the most beautiful section of the state. We have 4 full seasons."
"I know. You don't have to sell me on the area. We've been living here for over 5 months now. It's a beautiful place. But we're not happy with the antagonism between Bonita Vista and the town. And to tell you the truth, we've been having a few problems with the Homeowners Association."
I understand, Doris said. Again, she touched his leg. You had a 30-year fixed, right? Why don't I just go out and get your file, and we can talk this over? He was glad to be away from her, if only for a moment, and he took a deep cleansing breath, only now realizing how tense her unwanted attention had made him. He moved his chair back, away from hers to give himself some space. He wished there was another real estate agency in Corbin, but he was stuck. Doris was the only game in town. She returned with a manila file folder, closed the door behind her, and sat down in her chair, scooting it forward until they were again right next to each other.
"Do you have any idea what we could sell it for?" he asked.
"We'll let it go for the same price we paid if we have to, but if we could make a profit, that would be even better." "I'm sorry," she said brightly. "You can't sell your house."
"What?"
"Your homeowners association has invoked a bylaw that allows it to freeze assets, in this case your house and property, should you be involved in any disagreement or dispute with the association. Apparently you have refused to pay numerous fines and charges levied against you."
"They can't do that."
"They've done it. I have a note attached here to your file."
"What if I don't acknowledge that? What if we sell it anyway?"
She laughed. "Oh, sugar, it's in the agreement you signed."
"What agreement?"
"Why, your homeowners association agreement." She sorted through the sheaf of papers. "Hold on, I have it right here." She handed him a legal-sized sheet of densely packed type. Buried in the reams of contracts and documents they'd signed when initially buying the house, was an agreement to abide by all of the bylaws, rules, regulations, covenants, conditions, and restrictions of the Bonita Vista Homeowners Association. Barry read through the carefully written legalese. They had effectively ceded to the association rights and powers that no sane or halfway intelligent person would ever grant anyone else. How could he and Maureen have signed such a thing? He didn't remember the document at all, and couldn't imagine he would put his signature on an agreement without reading it. But there it was, in black and white. "Here," she said, "I'll make you a Xerox." He nodded, acting calmer than he felt. "Thank you." 5 minutes later, he was outside, holding his copy, blinking in the hot August sun. If before he'd felt paranoid about living in Bonita Vista, now he felt positively trapped. There was no way out. They were doomed to remain here unless they caved in and forked over money for the excessive and unjust fines imposed by the association. He drove back to Bonita Vista distressed, unhappy, and filled with a bleak resignation. At the gate, the guard smirked at him, as if knowing exactly what had occurred. He parked the Suburban in the driveway and sat for a moment. He sighed heavily. Maybe they should pay off their fines. Such a thought would have been inconceivable even an hour ago, but principles no longer seemed quite so important. If they could pay off their fines and then sell the house at a profit, they might emerge from this mess at least no worse off than when they started. He unbuckled his seatbelt and got out of the vehicle, walking over to check the mail before going back inside the house. In the mailbox, in addition to bills and a horror newsletter, was a homeowners association form ordering them to trim and or replace all dead manzanita bushes on their property or face a stiff fine of up to $500 for each day the problem was not rectified. Something snapped within him.
"Fuck!" he yelled. "Fuck! Fuck!"
He tore up the notice, ripping the sheet into ever smaller pieces. They were the ones who put in those dead manzanitas. They had purposely replaced Maureen's plants with sick and dying bushes, and now they were blaming the two of them for the manzanita's unacceptable condition, using it as a pretense for imposing even more unwarranted fines.
"Fuck!"
"Barry?" He must have been yelling louder than he thought, because Maureen was on the porch steps looking worriedly in his direction.
"They're fining us for the dead manzanitas!" he shouted. "Those fuckers ripped out our plants and charged us for it, replaced them with dead bushes and charged us for it. Now they're fining us $500 fucking a day."
She walked over to him, took his hands.
"Don't worry. We're getting out. We don't have to put up with this lunacy anymore."
"No, we're not."
"We're not what?" getting out. Doris said they have some type of lien on our house. We can't sell it or rent it out or do anything with it until we pay off the money we supposedly owe the association. Maureen paled. You're kidding. No. We're stuck here until we pay the fines. Unless we want to just bail and take a loss on this place, leave it here and let the fines pile up.
We can't afford that. I mean, we could afford it, barely, but it would be financially irresponsible and self-destructive.
The accountant in her had kicked in. The fines would pile up, and all of this would go on our credit record. I'm not paying them a dime, he said.
I know how you feel, but I would have,
he shouted, in case someone was listening in.
But I'll be damned if I let those monkey dicks pull this kind of stunt.
Then what are we going to do?
Nothing. We're staying right here and we're not paying a fucking dime. Let the fines accumulate, he yelled. We don't care.
What if they try to collect?
Her voice lowered.
What if they send volunteers?
Bring them on! Barry shouted out as loud as he could. You hear me, assholes? Bring them on! The next morning, the manzanita bushes were gone, replaced with an assortment of thorny, rough-looking shrubs. A notification form stated that the deteriorated condition of their property was unacceptable, and that voluntary entreaties had been ignored at this address in the past, so the association had taken upon itself the job of bringing the yard up to code. A bill for both the plants and the labor would be sent to them within 2 working days. His anger had faded, and in its place was a familiar sense of hopelessness. He'd been seesawing between those emotions far too often lately, and he had no rational explanation for it. Was it this place doing it to him? He could not dismiss the possibility. He recalled a theory he'd once read about the Superstition Mountains in Arizona. Prospectors looking for the lost Dutchman invariably went crazy searching for the mythical mine, becoming paranoid and murderous. According to this hypothesis, the mountains were magnetic, and it affected the brains of anyone who stayed within their borders for too long. Maybe something like that was happening here. Maybe not. Days passed, and Barry felt as though they were not only under siege, but isolated and completely alone. Neighbors waved to them on the street when they walked. Mike and Tina came over with a list of all the anti-association people they could remember from Ray's parties and stayed for dinner. They played a pickup game of tennis with another couple they met on the court. But everything seemed false and superficial. He and Maureen were putting on public faces that masked the real feelings underneath, and he had the sneaking suspicion that everyone else was doing the same. Maureen, at least, was keeping busy, doing work for her California clients, but he himself was lost. Although he'd made token efforts, he had not yet started writing again. Not even a short story. Each time he broke out his pen and notebook and sat down to write, he drew a blank. Maybe he could sue the association for loss of wages due to pain and suffering. A week after his trip to the real estate office, they were eating lunch on the deck, and the painters showed up. He didn't know who they were at first, assumed they were some type of inspectors sent by the association to snoop around their yard. He intended to ignore their existence the same way he ignored the endless stream of fines and notices, but when the four men unrolled a massive plastic drop cloth on the driveway, quickly pulled paint guns out of the back of the truck, turned on a compressor, and started spraying the front of the house, he threw down his sandwich. That's it! He pulled open the sliding glass door and ran downstairs and outside. What the hell are you doing? He demanded. This is my house! The three men painting the windowless section of the front wall with a coat of brown ignored him completely. But the oldest man, a bald fellow applying masking tape to the windows, looked over as he approached. We've been hired to repaint this residence, he said. The work order's in my truck. You want to see it? I don't give a damn about your work order, Barry yelled. This is my house, and I don't want it painted. Now you stop where you are and make that section the same color it was. Can't do it, Mac. The old man continued taping up the window. I got a work order from your homeowners association. You got a beef, take it up with them. But the way I understand it is they asked you to change the color and conform. You wouldn't do it, so they called us.
I don't believe this shit.
I'm sorry, the old man said. But like I said, you got to take it up with them. They're the ones paying the bill. He gave Barry a sympathetic look. That's why I wouldn't live in no neighborhood with a homeowners association.
Who were these men? Were they from Corbin?
They had to be. After his experience at the coffee shop, and especially after the rally, he'd assumed that the townspeople were of one mind and were all antagonistic toward Bonita Vista. But he realized that there was a whole class of workers whose livings were intertwined with the gated community and whose livelihoods depended on it. Economics made strange bedfellows. Again, he thought that everyone Bonita Vista touched was somehow corrupted.
"I don't want my house painted," Barry said, and this time it sounded more like a plea than a demand.
"Sorry," the old man said again. "Nothing I can do. I got my work order."
They slept that night with all of the windows closed, but the house still smelled like paint. The next day, they received a request for reimbursement from the Homeowners Association for the amount owed the painters, $5,000. He was sitting on the deck, staring drunkenly at the sunset, when Maureen quietly slid open the door and sat down next to him. In her hand was a stack of pink association forms and a computer printout.
"I've been adding up all of our fines and charges," she said.
"And?"
"It's almost $100,000.
He practically spit out his beer.
"What?" "I know. I couldn't believe it either.
But it's over $25,000 for the initial landscaping."
"25? Let me finish."
She ran down a list of overcharged services and exorbitant fines.
"Well, we're not paying them anything."
"They'll take our house.
We're going to owe more than the house is worth."
Maureen's eyes widened.
"That's their plan," she said wonderingly. "That's exactly what they want. They want to take our home and drive us into bankruptcy. Jesus, why didn't I see it before?"
She looked at him.
"The fines? Okay, they might be settled by taking the house, but the work, the painting, the landscaping, materials, and labor? Those involve tradespeople who have to be paid. Do you honestly think that the association is going to let us off the hook for those charges? Hell no. They'll take us to court. And we'll lose because the work was done, the services were provided, and we owe."
She took a deep breath.
"They're going to ruin us."
"Should have listened to Greg Davidson," Barry said. "Hey, maybe I could volunteer to work it off."
"Don't even joke about that," Maureen scolded him.
She was right. It wasn't very funny. He wished he had something else to say, wished he had some sort of plan to get them out from under this, but he didn't, and he drank his beer and stared out at the sunset in silence.
39.
She couldn't take it anymore. Liz stared at the phone in her hand for a long while, then took a deep breath and dialed the number of Jasper Calhoun. A chill passed through her as the old man answered.
"Hello, Elizabeth."
How had he known it was her?
Caller ID, she told herself. A lot of people had it these days. There was nothing unusual or mysterious about it. Still, she thought of his odd face with its unnatural complexion, and the cold within her grew.
"What can I do for you?" he asked.
Even after all that had happened, she had too much pride to beg. She refused to give Calhoun the satisfaction of pleading for mercy, but they'd broken her. For all her tough talk and firm intentions, she had not been able to hold up under the constant onslaught. Maureen and Tina and Audrey and Moira could say they supported her and offer her friendship and hope, but they weren't with her at night. They weren't there in the house when the bad things happened. Last night had been the last straw. She'd heard voices calling her from outside, seen lights shining on various windows, even through the drapes, and she turned on the television to distract her. What she saw took her breath away and caused her to fall back onto the couch. On BVTV, for all to see, was the death of Ray. It was a reenactment, she knew that. But damn it, the man looked a lot like her husband. And she watched as he slipped in the shower and hit his head on the hard porcelain. He lay there for a few moments, head bleeding, then got groggily to his feet and staggered out of the bathroom to the kitchen, where he attempted to pick up the phone. The show was depicting the Association's version of events, the story they wanted everyone to believe, and though Liz knew it wasn't true, she wanted to believe it too. She could believe it, she decided. She just wanted all this to stop. The man who looked like Ray stumbled onto the deck, then fell over the railing to the hard ground below, his already bleeding head landing sickeningly atop an irregularly shaped rock. The camera cut to a scene inside the house where Liz saw herself, her real self, not an impersonator, sobbing on the couch. She let out an anguished cry, unable to endure this cruel indignity, a whole host of hurtful emotions churning within her. Immediately, the scene switched to a live feed, and she saw and heard herself wailing in real time. She shut off the television, ran into the bedroom, jumped on the bed, and hid under the covers, pulling in arms and legs and head so no part of her was exposed. There might be a camera in this room, too, but it wouldn't be able to capture her. The camera could focus on her blanket and bedspread all night as far as she was concerned. They would not get another shot of her. She was filled with bleak despair and a crushing sense of loss. She replayed in her mind the scenes she'd just witnessed on TV. Ray's reenacted death had been filmed here, at her home, and she wondered when and how that had occurred. She'd left the house only briefly and infrequently since the funeral, and it was impossible for them to have staged such elaborate setups in those brief snatches of time. At night, she thought. They filmed it at night. That's what she'd heard. That's what the noises were. But filming those scenes only accounted for some of the noises. What else was going on? What else were they doing here? She felt even more violated than she had before. Having her suspicions confirmed, knowing with certainty that others had been in her house, gave her not only a feeling of powerlessness, but hopelessness. She did not know how much longer she could put up with this. She did not know how much longer she could survive this constant barrage. So she decided to meet the Association halfway. "Elizabeth," Calhoun prodded. "I'd like to talk," she said. The president chuckled. "I knew you'd come around. I don't want to be on the board," she insisted. "I just want to talk," he said. "I know. Why don't you open up your door and let me in? We'll discuss the best way to handle this situation." Open her door? Liz hurried out of the kitchen and into the entryway, where she looked through the peephole. He was on the porch, standing on the welcome mat, talking to her on his cell phone. "Don't let him in," a voice inside her said, and the voice spoke in Ray's dulcet tones. But she could not endure any more of this. She was not as strong as Ray had been, and alone, without his unflagging self-confidence and dogged determination, she could not stand up to their harassment. "Don't." Taking a deep breath, she unlocked and opened the door. The president stepped inside, smiling, and she shivered as he touched her shoulder. "It'll be all right now," he told her. "Everything's all right. Everything will be fine." 40. "I guess we weren't invited." Barry and Maureen stood in the darkened guest bedroom, staring out the open window. The cool breeze, a preview of approaching autumn, carried with it the sound of revelers. Through the trees, a concentration of lights at the community center created an irregular dome of illumination in the moonless night sky. They'd seen cars driving down earlier, and people walking. He knew from previous flyers that the community center would be having its grand unveiling this week, but they'd never been told a specific date and had received no invitation to the gala. Other people obviously had. He moved over to the east window and looked out. He saw more lights than usual twinkling through the pine branches. People had left their porch lights on while they'd gone down to see the new center. "It looks like almost everyone went," he said. "You can't tell that by looking out the window." "Call it a hunch." "I doubt if Liz went," Maureen offered helpfully. He snorted. "Yeah, that makes me feel better." "Come on,"
Do you honestly think they're all going to turn into rabid association supporters just because they went to a party? Most of them probably only showed up for the free food and drink. Maybe. What's that mean? You know damn well what it means. He turned to face her, seeing only an impressionistic version of her features in the darkness. They get their way, the association. I don't know if it's magic or... I don't know what it is. But these people are on their side. Look at the sheriff. Look at everyone who showed up to head off that rally. We were there under duress, but most of our beloved neighbors were there on their own, happily brandishing their weapons and longing for a fight. Then maybe it's a good thing we're ostracized. Maybe they'd convert us too. No, he said firmly. That could never happen. And the same goes for other people. Not all of them, maybe, but some of them. Mike and Tina. A few of the others we met. He remembered the party at Ray's when Greg Davidson had announced his intention to leave Bonita Vista, and everyone had gathered around swapping anti-association stories. Maybe, he said. Hopefully. He moved next to her, and they stood at the window, staring into the darkness, listening to the party.
Labor Day's only a week away, Maureen said softly.
I know. Are we going to go to the meeting?
Of course. This is our chance to make everything public. According to the rules, each homeowner gets 3 minutes to say whatever they want. I'm going to write a speech, and I'm going to suggest amendments, and by the end of it, at the very least, we'll find out who stands where. I'm taking those bastards to task, and we'll see who's with me or against me.
You? What about me?
Us, he amended.
No, I mean, what about me? Do I get to speak too?
He was surprised.
Do you want to?
No.
But is it 3 minutes for me and 3 minutes for you, or 3 minutes total? If we can stretch our time out to six, I'll take up where you leave off and keep talking.
It's 3 minutes per lot.
Then the floor is all yours.
I have to start working on this now, time myself, try to cram in as much as I can. The annual meeting is the one time a year they even make the pretext that this is a democracy. It's our only shot. We've got to make it count.
A lone skyrocket exploded in the air above the community center, purple sparkles falling down on the trees. A loud cheer went up.
What do you think will happen? Maureen asked.
Barry was silent for a moment.
I don't know, he said finally. I don't know.
The painters returned in the morning. This time, Barry and Maureen were both in the driveway before the men had emerged from their truck.
"What do you think you're doing here?" Maureen demanded as the painters got out of the cab and walked around to the rear of the vehicle.
They ignored her.
"You just painted our house a week ago."
The three younger men pulled out their tarp and started spreading it on the driveway. Barry walked up to the old man.
"Let me guess," he said. "This color is no longer acceptable. They want you to paint it a different shade."
The painter pulled a roll of masking tape from the bed of the truck.
Yep.
Have you done this before? Painted the same house over and over again until the owners go bankrupt?
He paused for a moment, as if hesitant to answer, then nodded his head.
Yep. He pushed past Barry and started taping up the nearest window. They left before the painting started, closing up the house and driving out to the lake, where they spent the day hiking and picnicking and pretending that they were a normal couple having a normal day. When they arrived home late in the afternoon, the painters were gone, but their tarp remained draped over bushes on the south side of the house, and only half of the building was completed.
"I guess they're coming back tomorrow," Maureen said.
Barry nodded. They'd slept with the windows closed last time, and that hadn't worked. So this time they left the windows open and the fan on, but the smell of paint still permeated everything, and they both awoke in the morning with headaches. The job took 2 days. The painters were clearly being more thorough than before, which made Barry think that this sequence had been thoroughly planned in advance. This would turn out to be a more expensive job, he was sure, and while a part of him wanted to physically throw the painters off his property and burn their truck, he knew they were only following orders and would merely be replaced by someone else. He thought of another idea, though, and he talked to Maureen, told her of his plan. To his surprise, she agreed. They waited until the painters were done. After they left, he and Maureen took the white interior latex left over from their remodeling and painted a gigantic happy face on the wall of the house facing the street. On the north wall of the house, they painted a frowning face. The next day, the workers were back. This time, they were not merely uncommunicative, they were openly hostile. When Barry met them in the driveway, drinking his morning coffee and offering them a hearty hello, they gave him dirty looks and muttered obscenities. "Who does he think he is?" one of the younger painters asked another. "Stupid fuck," the old man muttered. His plan had worked. He and Maureen had thrown a monkey wrench into the association's schedule, had reset the agenda on their terms. The painters taped off the windows, put down their drop cloth, hooked up the sprayers, and obliterated the left half of the happy face. After they moved to another section of wall, Barry put down his coffee, took out his white paint, and started brushing it on the recently completed area, making a series of X's in a random pattern. The old man stormed over to him. "Just what do you think you're doing?" "It's my house," Barry told him, "and I'm painting it." "You can't. It's my house. I can do anything I damn well please, and if you don't get out of my face, I'm going to kick your fucking ass, strip you naked, and paint you yellow like the coward you are." He expected the old man to threaten him, to tell him that there were four of them and only one of him. He was even prepared for a fight right then and there should the bald asshole rush him. But the painter turned and walked away, spoke to his co-workers, and a few minutes later the four of them packed up their gear and left. A victory. The painters did not return, no others took their place, and there was not even any sign of Neil Campbell and his ubiquitous clipboard. No one called, no notices were left in their mailbox or on their door. The half a happy face and random X's remained on the wall. That night, they made love, and in the middle of it, the phone rang. He wanted to let it ring, but Maureen insisted that he answer, it might be important, so he reached over to the nightstand, picked up the phone, and pressed the talk button. "Hello?" The voice on the line was harsh yet whispery. "Throw her another hump for me." Click. Someone was watching them. They were being monitored. He pulled the sheets over their bodies and looked frantically around the room, searching for a hidden camera. "What are you doing?" Maureen demanded, squirming uncomfortably beneath him. He rolled off her. His erection was gone. Still hidden by the blanket, he reached down to the floor for his underwear. He pulled on his briefs and ran over to the television, turning it on. On BVTV was a video of him and Maureen making love. Maureen was on top, and the camera zoomed in on her buttocks as his hand slid down and into her crack. "Sons of bitches!" Barry yelled. "Sons of bitches!" The phone rang again, but this time neither of them answered it. In the morning, their house had been painted black. 41. The Bonita Vista Homeowners Association Covenants, Conditions, and Restrictions, Article 5, Security and Control, Section 9, Paragraph A. The association and any of its committees or subcommittees has the right to monitor residents on any section of the community properties or on any jointly owned right-of-way in any manner it deems appropriate using any means at its disposal. Residents whose dues are in arrears or who are involved in disputes with the board may be monitored anywhere at any time, including in their private residences. 42. It was hard writing a speech. He was used to creating dialogue, having two characters express ideas and points of view through conversation, but coming up with a stirring, rabble-rousing address in the real world was quite a bit different from doing so within the boundaries of a fictional universe in which he controlled all of the variables and all of the reactions. He was not and never had been a public speaker, so the fact that he would be performing this himself, and before a hostile audience no less, brought additional pressure. His first draft clocked in at a whopping 15 minutes. He pared it down as much as he could, read it to Maureen, and it still came in at 12. He would have to be selective, and he would have to be merciless. It was impossible to fit in everything he wanted to say, so he would be able to address only his most important concerns and use the most egregious examples of the association's transgressions. But he was having a hard time figuring out what those were. He scrolled down the computer screen, reread his words for the 100th time. "Tape!" Maureen called from the living room. He hurried upstairs. He'd been videotaping BVTV all day and night, fast-forwarding and reviewing the tapes every 6 hours as they filled up, looking for anything filmed in their house. He had figured out where the camera in the bedroom was from the angle of the shot he'd seen on the television, and he'd torn out that section of wall until he found the device, which he'd immediately smashed. How someone had gotten the camera into that spot was a mystery, and the only thing he could figure was that it had been built into the house during initial construction and had been there ever since. They'd patched over the hole in the wall as best as two amateurs could, but it still looked like hell, and Maureen had hung a framed Georgia O'Keeffe poster over the space to hide the bulging spackle. So far, they'd seen no indication that any of the other rooms in the house were under surveillance, but he wouldn't put anything past Calhoun and his cronies, and he continued his close monitoring of BVTV. The day before the association's annual meeting, Barry finally had a speech he was happy with. It still ran long, 4 minutes instead of three, even speaking fast, but he figured he could keep talking while they told him his time was up and get the last little bit in before he was cut off completely. Celebrities did it on award shows all the time. It was a legitimate tactic. They went to bed early, both of them exhausted from stress. They made love for the first time since discovering the camera, and talked for a while about what they would do and where they would go when they finally escaped Bonita Vista. Gradually, the pauses between their sentences grew longer, and their voices slowed as they started to drift off. He wasn't sure when he finally slipped into sleep, but at some point he was no longer lying in his bed. He was sitting on a hard metal folding chair with all of his neighbors. At a table on a raised stage, Jasper Calhoun and the rest of the berobed board were gazing imperiously out at the tightly packed crowd. The president announced in a strong, clear tone, "Additions to the CC&Rs include a provision declaring that all men may buttfuck Maureen Welch at their convenience without her permission or the permission of her husband, Barry. All those in favor?" A sea of hands shot up with Nuremberg precision. "All those opposed?" Only Barry's hand was raised. "Passed." He awoke in the morning looking across the pillow into Maureen's open eyes. "Meeting today," she said. The room was packed. Most of the people he did not recognize, but there were others he did. Mike and Tina, Frank and Audrey, Lou and Stacy, Neil, Chuck and Terry, individuals from Ray's parties, homeowners he'd seen at the rally. They were seated on metal folding chairs, and there must have been over 100 of them. In the front of the room was the board. In the back were the volunteers. The layout was remarkably similar to that of his dream, and he experienced an uncomfortable feeling of déjà vu as he and Maureen walked into the community center. There should have been voices, should have been talking. The large room should have been filled with the buzz of numerous conversations, but everyone was quiet, each of them glancing through enormous black-bound books that lay in their laps. To the right of the doorway, Barry saw, was a table piled high with dozens of identical volumes. A man standing next to the table, dressed absurdly in livery, motioned them over. "Please pick up your revised copy of the Bonita Vista Homeowners Association Declaration of Covenants, Conditions, and Restrictions," he said. "Ratification is the first item on today's agenda." He handed Barry a book. It weighed a ton, and was the size of the oversized family Bible that his grandmother used to keep on her dining room table. "We're supposed to read through this entire thing in, what, 5 or 10 minutes? Barry asked. "It's just a formality," the man said. "How can we make an informed decision if we don't know what's in there?" The man laughed. "That's a good one." The laugh was genuine, and it made Barry uneasy. The idea that the votes of the homeowners were important and actually meant something struck this man as legitimately funny. An ominous sign. Liz was seated near the closest aisle, and she waved them over. She'd saved the two seats next to her, and he and Maureen exchanged a glance as they walked up. It was as if nothing unusual had ever happened, as if she had not been a paranoid recluse for the better part of 2 months, and her normality was disconcerting. Liz smiled as they sat down and said she was glad they'd come. She hadn't been sure they would. She spoke in whispers, and though Barry wanted to talk in a normal tone of voice, wanted to demonstrate that he was unintimidated and unafraid, he found himself whispering back, daunted by the silence of everyone around him.
"There's no way we'd miss this," he said. "I finally have an opportunity to give that board a piece of my mind."
"Please pick up your revised copy of the Bonita Vista Homeowners Association Declaration of Covenants, Conditions, and Restrictions," the man in livery said from his post near the table as someone new walked in. His voice sounded absurdly loud in the stillness. "Ratification is the first item on today's agenda." Barry placed the massive volume on his lap and opened it up. Liz's copy, he noticed, was on the floor next to her. Several of the people around them had also laid their books on the floor, though some were attempting to read through the amended regulations. He turned pages randomly. There was a rule disallowing the cooking of Asian food at any residence, another stating that all homeowners must own an American flag, although the flag could not be displayed either in or outside the house. He flipped quickly through the book. The regulations grew wackier and wackier. Only No. 2 pencils could be used to write grocery lists. Residents were required to wash their hair daily and use conditioner. Baldness was not acceptable in public, and homeowners who were losing their hair had to wear toupees outside the privacy of their homes. He was certain that there were dangerous edicts hidden among the frivolous, ridiculous ordinances, but there was no time to find them, and he was glad that he'd prepared a speech ahead of time. If people were going to automatically ratify regulations with which they were completely unfamiliar, they needed to hear what he had to say. He'd told Mike about his planned speech, asked his friend to spread the word, and Barry could only hope that he had. He glanced around the silent crowd. If everything went well, people would respond to his questioning of the board with questions of their own, and those old men would find themselves under attack, forced to defend policies and procedures that until this point had been taken for granted. Even the best-laid plans went astray, and this was a half-baked scheme to begin with, but he had faith that he might be able to at least stir things up here today. The president's gavel fell on the table with the sharp suddenness of a gunshot, and Barry jumped along with everyone else. All eyes turned toward the raised platform on which sat the board of directors.
"Hear ye, hear ye," the man in livery announced from the back of the room. "The annual meeting of the Bonita Vista Homeowners Association will now come to order."
Jasper Calhoun, seated at the center of the table, stood and smiled munificently.
"Welcome, neighbors," he said.
A huge cheer went up. The people around them began clapping wildly, and Barry looked at Maureen. He'd been sitting there waiting for a follow-up sentence, having no idea that the president's simple greeting would be an applause cue, and the response of his fellow homeowners was as startling and unexpected as the rap of the gavel had been. He had a sudden uneasy suspicion that this was part of some ritual, like a church service, with programmed cues and responses. Leaning over Maureen, he spoke to Liz.
"How long do these meetings usually last?" he whispered.
2 or 3 hours,
she whispered back.
2 or 3 hours?
The president beamed at the crowd, and his smile grew even wider, though that was not something Barry would have thought physically possible. The disproportionate breadth of his mouth gave Calhoun's face a creepy, wolf-like appearance.
"We will begin this meeting with the most important task facing us today, voting on our covenants, conditions, and restrictions."
Another cheer.
"You've all had time to look over the amended declaration. All those in favor of accepting the revisions, raise your hands."
Arms shot into the air. Barry was thrown off guard.
"Wait," he yelled, leaping to his feet. "Aren't we going to discuss this? We opposed?"
the president said. The gavel was rapped on the table before Barry even had a chance to raise his hand or finish his sentence.
"The amendments are accepted," Calhoun announced.
Barry stood there dumbly, looking around at his seated neighbors, all of whom seemed to be eagerly awaiting the next word from the president's lips. "They're all hypnotized," he thought. "It's the only explanation." But he knew that wasn't true. He glanced down at Maureen. She, too, seemed stunned.
The idea that such a massive revision of a document affecting the lives and property of everyone here could be approved in a single vote and without any discussion, without time to even fully comprehend all the changes, was unbelievable. Barry was still standing, and Calhoun pointed at him with the gavel. "Mr. Welch, would you please have a seat?" He faced the president. "I want to know why there wasn't any discussion about these revisions. Isn't it normal to vote on amendments individually, after people have a chance to give their opinions?" "This is Bonita Vista," Calhoun said, as if that explained everything. "Please sit down so we may continue our meeting." Barry was aware of the hostile stares directed at him from some of the other homeowners, and he felt Maureen tugging on his shirt sleeve. He still had his speech to give, but this apparently wasn't the time for member comment, and since he wanted to win over the crowd and not alienate them, he sat down. He had not expected the other residents to be so in sync with the board, and it worried him. On the platform, one of the other board members handed the president a slip of paper. Calhoun nodded at the man, then faced the audience. "A motion has been made to do away with all cats in the town of Corbin. As you know, we have begun our process of eliminating dogs, but as the eradication of all pets is our ultimate goal and part of our ongoing effort to bring Corbin into the Bonita Vista family, it has been suggested that we begin killing cats. Shall we put this to a vote?" "Yes," the crowd shouted. Again, Barry thought of the church analogy. There was definitely a ritualistic element to this meeting that he and Maureen were not privy to, and that did not sit well with him. Even more unnerving was the subject matter. He had known the association was behind the dog poisonings, but he'd assumed that it was a decision made by the board. The idea that the entire membership had voted on and approved such a horrific and inhuman policy threw him for a loop. Had they approved the child murders as well? Goosebumps rippled down his skin. "All those in favor of expanding the pet eradication to include cats and kittens, raise your hands,"